was growing sad while Bobby sang the blues. With them windshield wipers slapping time out, Bobby clapping hands, we finally sang up every song that driver knew.
Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Tuesday, the 1st of October. Wow, a new month. October 1st, and we have a lot to talk about this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. A delight to have you here, and we enjoy your company, and we thank you for tuning in. We always welcome you to be a part of the program by simply writing to us, panel@wamc.org. As you may, as you probably know and may know, is that over the last 2 weeks or so, we've been doing special panels through much of the week. Today is a good old-fashioned regular panel, as we would call it, a regular panel. No less special, by the way, but a regular panel. And not only do we have regular panel, but we'll have a special debate panel tonight at 7 o'clock. From 7 to 9, we'll be on, and we'll be talking about the vice presidential debate, and to get you ready for that event, which takes place at 9 p.m. will be simulcast from CBS on NPR, and we'll be leading up to it as we did for the presidential debate. We'll be doing that for the vice presidential debate tonight, and that should be a lot of fun. So we look forward to that. That's a lockbox event. If you would like to get in early, we're going to be asking you for help during the lockbox. But if you want to do it right now and clear your conscience early, well, who are we to stop you? WAMC.org, WAMC.org. And I'll be telling you a lot more about the panel tonight, but just keep it in your mind. The coverage begins at our coverage begins at 7. The debate is at 9, and we'll be raising funds and talking about the debate as we did the last time, and be having a really interesting conversation on that tonight. So that is what is going on. Then also I want to mention that WANC, which is 103.9 Ticonderoga, was off the air, could be off the air frequently to allow for tower climbers to safely complete extensive work. Now, what I haven't told is that the three panelists here are our tower climbers. So at various times, they're gonna come in.
Don't tempt me, Joe.
Yeah, they're going to come in, and they're going to bring you out in the pickup truck, and you're going to head up to Ty, and then you'll be back. How would you like that job? Tower climbers. But the tower climbers are going up, and so we don't kill them, we go off the air. And so they can do some extensive work, and it's safe. So we apologize for the inconvenience and appreciate your patience. And if you are up in that neck of the woods and you hear this and know your neighbor may not, you can let them know that we'll be off the air on and off as the climbing commences in Ticonderoga. Again, we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. Two more special notes, and then I'll leave you alone with special stuff. One is that it is Jimmy Carter's 100th birthday today.
Happy birthday.
My goodness. The 39th president of the United States, and a Nobel laureate, and just one of our great leaders of all time, and turns 100, and he will, it's a momentous, he went into hospice over, I think, 15 months ago, something like that, and I don't think many people thought that it would, that he would live to 100, and he has, and he has stressed that he's wants to hold on till the election and cast his vote. And so Jonathan Alter, a columnist and a historian and a biographer who wrote the definitive biography of Jimmy Carter, will be joining us at 10:30 to talk about James Earl Carter at 10:30 this morning. Finally, last but not least, tomorrow we're going to be doing not one but two special programs. From 9 to 10:30, we will be doing a debate wrap-up, and talking about the debate, and we'll be raising money for the Lockbox. And then from 10:30 to noon, we will have Judith Inc. and a cast of recycling and environmental experts with her to talk about recycling, the environment, and plastics. That coming up from 10:30 to noon tomorrow. So a lot coming up over the next 24 hours. I just have to keep track of it all. All right. So let me introduce the panel to you. By the way, WAMC.org to get in. We would love to hear from you. WAMC.org to help in all of these facets with the Lockbox. Panel at WAMC.org if you'd like to have a question or two. We'd love to hear from you. All right, let me introduce the group to you and we'll get started. The Ulster County Controller and the former president and CEO of the Community Foundations of the Hudson Valley, March Gallagher, is here. Hello, March.
Good morning. Happy October. I'm doing it old school. I brought a paper check and I'm hoping everybody listening will join me in contributing to the Lockbox because, you know, I'm a comptroller. I like efficient things. So I like to get the fund drive done in an efficient way, and it saves time and money if you give early.
Check is a great way, and that's right. That is a good vote of confidence from our controller. That's good stuff. So thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. Also, we welcome Ambassador Fred Hoff, former U.S. Army officer and State Department diplomat, who taught at Bard College for 6 years, now a senior fellow at Bard Center for Civic Engagement. Ambassador Fred Hoff, good morning. How are you?
Hey, good morning, Joe. Delighted to see you and happy. We're going to be having Mr. Alter on later on discussing Jimmy Carter. You know, President Carter's term in office, I think, will be, controversial and debatable, for decades and centuries to come. But I think one thing is certain. He's the finest ex-president of the United States who's ever lived.
Yes. And Alter makes the case of a pretty good presidency,
and,
too.
Yes, he does.
So we'll be talking about that. But no, I absolutely agree with you. We also welcome Jay Jochnowitz. He's semi-retired, but he still seems to be working all the time. I don't know how that works, but I'm semi-retired. I don't know what that means. Editor at large, columnist, editorial writer for the Times Union. Good morning, Jay.
Good morning, Joe. I'm wishing I could be on the recycling panel now because I would like this to be the moment that they change the labeling on recycling to actually tell you this is recyclable as opposed to the little triangle that seems to say it's theoretically recyclable, but it may not be,
but we don't know.
We may bury it.
Yeah. I think we're going to bring this up in the show tomorrow, if I remember. But they have these little markings on the bottoms of things where it'll just be like a box with like little waves. And I'm like, I don't know
yes,
what that means.
I don't know.
Does that mean I can wash it? Does that mean I can
machine washable.
Machine washable. Can I put it in the, is it going to melt? I don't know.
Yeah.
Now, and of course, Judith is going to say, well, if it's plastic, you shouldn't have it anyway.
Yeah,
<That's true. laughs> but we'll fight that battle tomorrow. Welcome to the program, all. Let's get started with the topics for today, and we have a lot. As I said, we've been doing these events and special panels. So some of the things that have been happening in our world, we have been mentioning less than we normally would on the panel, so I want to give them some time and some air today. Of course, one of the big stories is Israel beginning ground operations in southern Lebanon. Israeli troops crossed the border after a prolonged bombing campaign aimed at killing as many of Hezbollah's top leaders and destroying some of its weapons. This story is ongoing and is one that is concerning. The Israeli military announced early Tuesday that its troops had begun crossing into southern Lebanon, saying that they would destroy Hezbollah military infrastructures and villages close to the Israeli-Lebanon border. In a statement issued shortly before 2 a.m., the military described the operation as limited and said that its troops had begun entering Lebanon a few hours ago in order to target sites that pose an immediate threat, quote, pose an immediate threat to Israeli communities in northern Israel. The invasion followed intense Israeli strikes across Lebanon over the past 2 weeks and have killed hundreds of people, according to the Lebanese Health Ministry, including 95 just yesterday. Israel is trying to force a conclusion to a war with Hezbollah that started in parallel with Israel's war with Hamas in Gaza, which was set off by the October 7th attacks on southern Israel last year. In the opening days of that war, Hezbollah started firing toward Israeli positions in solidarity with Hamas. Both groups are backed by Iran. Ambassador Hoff, let us begin with you on this most serious of topics.
Yeah, what appears to be happening, at least what the Israelis say is happening, is a very, very limited incursion into southern Lebanon, into areas in close proximity to Israeli towns and villages. Since October 8th of last year, when Hezbollah began firing into Israel in support of Palestinians, in support of Hamas, some 60,000 Israelis have had to be evacuated from northern Israel, and this has posed a political challenge to Prime Minister Netanyahu and his government. So obviously the government of Israel wants to set up a situation where these 60,000 people can return home. But this particular operation seems to be so far very, very limited, to the point where the only real threat that might be neutralized is the ability of Hezbollah fighters to fire, for example, anti-tank rounds into Israel from very short distances. Israel has a long and problematic history of ground invasions into Lebanon. You know, unless it wants to occupy Lebanese territory indefinitely and inspire the kind of insurgency it had to fight from 1982 to 2000, ultimately it's going to need the cooperation of Lebanon and the Lebanese army to secure this area. Otherwise, Hezbollah fighters can simply withdraw now and come back when Israeli forces depart. And it may be that Hezbollah fighters, who have had, 18 years since the last major combat in 2006 to prepare for this, may fight effectively in southern Lebanon for all we know. But ideally, a ceasefire will take hold before long, one that will enable the Lebanese army to deploy to southern Lebanon, and one that ideally would have Hezbollah forces moving north of the Litani River. It's possible that the Israel-Lebanon armistice arrived at in 1949, something that was renounced by Israel in 1967, could be revived. So there's a lot here where we're going to have to wait and see just how extensive this incursion is going to be. But I think if Israel keeps in front of its face achievable political objectives, this can work well. Otherwise, it could be a repeat of disasters Israel has faced previously when it's invaded Lebanon.
I have one follow-up for you, and then we'll probably take a break and come back and hear from both March and Jay on the other side of the break. But the other key to this, and what we learned yesterday, President Biden announcing that they'll be sending a few thousand more troops to the Middle East, the Pentagon said on Monday. Defense Department officials said the additional forces would bolster security for the 40,000 U.S. troops already in the region and help with the defense of Israel. Could you put that into some context for us of what that means? It's numbers, and in 50,000, it seems like a lot of men and women there, but it is of their job and their responsibility, and we should make of that announcement.
Yeah, we have to always keep in mind that there are American forces on the ground, roughly 2,500 in Iraq, close to 1,000 in Syria that have the mission of suppressing an ISIS insurgency, Islamic State insurgency in that area. Those troops are a potential target if Iran chooses to retaliate for all of this. The Biden administration has been counseling diplomacy, counseling limited military objectives to Israel. Whether or not Israel takes that advice, I don't know. But on the other hand, the administration is also supporting Israeli actions in Lebanon, notwithstanding questions about the way Israel is waging war in the Gaza Strip. But the United States sees the diminution of Iranian power and influence in the region as a good thing, and the diminution of Hezbollah influence in Lebanon and elsewhere in the region as a good thing.
I want diminution to be the word of the day, by the way.
Especially really with regard to this conflict,
yeah,
please.
Absolutely. And we need that's not an overreaction on our part. We need those troops there, that extra 10,000.
Yes, absolutely. They would have the mission not only of helping to defend American forces, but defending Israel, if need be, from an Iranian retaliation.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll hear from March Gallagher and Jay Jochnowitz on this issue. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. And we, of course, welcome you in the meantime to help out our lockbox, WAMC.org. We will return after this break of news from the BBC.
So you turn to your trusty old partner to share some old feelings. And you find to your shock that your faithful companion is gone.
Listening to the music of Chris Christopherson this morning, providing our bumper music throughout the panel. Chris Christopherson, a beloved musician and actor, died over the weekend at the age of 88, and we'll be playing some classic Chris Christopherson this morning. The playlist is posted online at wamc.org/roundtable. All right, welcome back to the panel. We have been discussing Israel beginning ground operations in southern Lebanon, Israeli troops crossing the border after a prolonged bombing campaign aimed at killing many of Hezbollah's top leaders and destroying some of its weapons. We heard from Ambassador Fred Hoff, March Gallagher.
Okay, so thank you, Joe. This is my least favorite topic on the roundtable, and I just want to say that up front. I'm going to give you the layperson thoughts after listening to Ambassador Hoff. I'm incredibly conflicted about this entire conflict. Conflicted about conflict, isn't that apropos? You know, we saw the horrors of October 7th. You know, there are still hostages being held. Israel definitely has a right to defend itself, but we are just seeing a tremendous loss of life. And every time I hear Israel say, you know, people need to move, I'm literally thinking about what I would be doing there with my mother with dementia and my kids if I had to move in that sort of circumstance, and the personal, you know, the humanitarian toll. I read this morning that Hezbollah said, you know, it was on Al Jazeera saying, no, they're not here. They haven't come in. That's not true. So I again feel like I don't know what to believe when I'm reading these things, especially early in you know, in the type of action that's happening right now. It's a 75-mile border, so what they're saying, you know, what Hezbollah is saying they see or is happening, you know, may not be true. I don't know. And also this idea of a limited engagement, I was thinking, like, wait, didn't we hear that before? Isn't that what they said about Rafah? It was going to be limited. So I have a lot of conflicted feelings and thoughts about it. And as a layperson trying to gather the news and, you know, make assessments of what's really happening, I find it a very, very challenging thing to do. I'm bouncing between the New York Times and the Washington Post and Al Jazeera and the AP Wire. And, you know, what is really happening is not able to be told. And I also want to just say I watched a chilling video of Benjamin Netanyahu speaking directly to the Iranian people. I don't know if anybody else on the panel watched that. It's about 2 minutes long. And there are places in the video where he is saying, you know, a lot of what he's saying has meaning for me, right? He's saying, you know, we support the Iranian people and the people of Iran are not the government. Okay, yes. But he's also saying, you know, if your government wasn't spending all this money on conflicts outside of their borders, there would be a lot more for water, sewer, and health care in your country. And I'm thinking, wow. Is he talking to the American people? It's the same message here. So, yeah, that's where I am. Very conflicted about the conflict. Hope that's helpful to the listener.
More conflict is always helpful. Jay.
Yeah, it was kind of a less poetic version of Golda Meir saying that when they start loving their children more than they hate us, these wars will end. And it was cold thing to say, and I think, you know, oversimplified the situation, but in its own way had something, you know, offered some context for people on the, you know, who are the victims of this or who have to pay for it in the case of Iran. You know, it's for a few moments there when I was watching this develop, I was thinking that God, not another thing that Netanyahu's doing. And then I kind of had to separate that from October 7th, because when somebody's taking, I mean, you know, I simplify it by just thinking, what if somebody was shooting at Plattsburgh in the North Country from Canada and the Canadian government wasn't doing anything about it, and you have a terrorist group in Quebec or Montreal just shooting at us, we would do something about it, and we would probably do something very similar in the way of shooting back at them. Fred had mentioned that, you know, this is ostensibly a limited engagement. The problem is they've got a lot more troops behind this group, this initial division that's going in massed along the border, and there's every indication. And I think that's maybe one of the reasons why Iran is being I'm not an expert on this by any means, but maybe why Iran at the moment is somewhat restrained here, that they don't want to – they don't know what Israel's move is next unless they have very good intelligence. And I don't know that Israel knows what its next move is, but, you know, we could end up with a real ground war there, or we could end up, as Israel is saying now, with, you know, kind of something, quote-unquote, I don't want to say it's surgical because it's really not. This is pretty blunt force, but it's not an all-out war. You know, I think that's going to be one of the challenges here in terms of American support for Israel in Congress. I think the White House is clear on what the problem is here, and that Gaza and Lebanon are, in a sense, they're connected, but not the same. Those subtleties are always understood in American politics so beautifully. I hope that Congress understands that Israel can't tolerate this, that it really does have a reason to be there. And, you know, as long as this doesn't explode into a whole Mideast war, I hate to say anything about Netanyahu like this, but I think it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, and just to follow up on a couple of these points, March emphasized the human cost here, and it is enormous. No matter the geopolitical benefits of giving Iran a hard punch to the mouth and really degrading the ability of Hezbollah to threaten Israel and hold Lebanon hostage, notwithstanding all that, out of 7 million Lebanese, you've got 1 million of them displaced from their homes. Out on sidewalks, out on beaches. It's raining right now. You're entering into a season in the Eastern Med where there's a lot of rain, where temperatures begin to drop. And Iran, you know, the leaders of the so-called Islamic Republic are not into personal martyrdom. All right?
No.
They've got a system that is corrupt, that enriches them, and misgoverns the people of Iran. The Iranian leaders, from the supreme leader on down, are quite willing to fight to the last Palestinian. They're not interested in engaging Israel. And I think Prime Minister Netanyahu understands this quite well. What the Iranians are on the verge of losing, though, is something very, very, very important. The main military mission of Hezbollah under the late Hassan Nasrallah was to provide a Lebanon-based deterrent on Israel from attacking Iran. That deterrent has been degraded badly. The main danger for Israel right now and for Israeli citizens is the Israeli military inadvertently backing Hezbollah into a use it or lose it situation, where local Hezbollah leaders decide, you know, let's launch everything we've got left. Let's mess up rush hour in Tel Aviv. Let's hit some infrastructure in Israel. This is still a danger. It's a risk that Israel is taking. And, you know, part of what Israel is calculating is that Iran, fearful of an Israeli attack, is telling Hezbollah, lay low for the time being. Try to preserve what you've got, because the last thing we want is to see Israeli F-15s, F-16s in Iranian airspace.
The thing I'm wishing we could see at this point, and there, I don't see any indication, but if Netanyahu, you know, there's so much talk about what his political future is and why he's doing all this and how much he is not liked by the Israelis. The one thing I would love to see, and I don't see any of this coming out of Israel, is what next? You know, when this is all over, when all the fighting is over, who has a vision for what's going to happen in the Middle East? And that is where if Netanyahu wanted to rise above his own circumstances, this would be the moment for him to start talking about what a Middle East looks like with peace.
And you know, if you're talking about Iran and Hezbollah, the best result there is for them to be flatly beaten. Mm-hmm. But to get to address what you're talking about, Jay, unless Israel has a forward-looking vision that includes Palestinian self-determination, mm-hmm. there is no end.
Absolutely.
There is no end. Israel has mastered things in the tactical realm. Okay. But in terms of political vision, in terms of an end game, in terms of the diplomacy needed to get there, at least on the Palestinian front, it's almost entirely lacking under current management.
Yeah.
And is it in Netanyahu's interest? You know, I mean, I think his political and his personal interest is not to see a ceasefire right now. That's my lay interpretation. And, you know, the conflict is benefiting him personally and politically. So I don't know that we're going to see his leadership lead to something. And I agree with you, Jay. It would be really nice to see what is the vision for what's next. You know, as I was reading this morning, I came across Resolution 1701, right, that ended the month-long conflict between Lebanon and Israel in 2006. And it bars Israeli forces from going into Lebanon. How is this not a violation? And how is the U.S. not really speaking on this when— You know, we won't even let Ukraine use our weapons to go into Russia. So I'm confused by that.
Yeah, 1701. Yeah, I guess you could say there's a chicken and egg dilemma here. 1701 also requires Hezbollah to abandon southern Lebanon in terms of military forces. Lebanon south of the Litani River is supposed to be entirely in the hands of official Lebanese armed forces and United Nations forces. No Hezbollah to the south.
Gotcha.
Israel would take the position, hey,
they breached it first.
We're going in because they breached it first. And they started the shooting on October 8th.
So we're going to take a break. When we come back, we have many letters. I want to get to those as well before the top of the hour, and then much more to discuss as we move through the morning this morning. We welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.
I'd smoke my brain the night before on cigarettes and songs that I'd been picking.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Talking about Israel beginning ground operations in southern Lebanon, we heard from our panelists. Now we'll hear from you. We have many letters. Let's go to Joanne. It keeps coming back to me that our tax dollars have paid for Israel's bombing campaign and will no doubt be on the hook for rebuilding. How does that make sense? If Israel were truly sincere in its quest for peace, it would stop the Zionists' constant incursion into Palestinian territory, destroying those people's homes and farms. Pete writes, I have a deep love for Lebanon and its people, a country caught between conflicts for decades, and I want peace. But just as Israel has a right to defend itself, so we hear time and time again, Lebanon does as well. Maybe the Lebanese army needs to fight back against these invaders, and maybe the Lebanese people need international help in doing so. We go to Ricky. Neither Hamas nor Hezbollah have any chance to defeat the much more, shouty caps, much more powerful Israel, and I'm sure they've always known that. What is their strategy in attacking Israel? Gene says, it sure seems like Netanyahu is dragging us into a wider war. Besides Netanyahu, Trump, and Putin, who would like this to happen? Hezbollah was attacking Israel because of what was happening in Gaza. Seems like forcing a ceasefire is the only solution to even more death and destruction. The U.S. should stop sending Israel weapons as it violates the Leahy Law. Secretary Blinken was just shown in a recent ProPublica article to have ignored two separate reports documenting war crimes and human rights violations by Israel. That from Gene. Then we go to Stu. Why do we never hear about the value of enemies for Israel on the panel? Why is it assumed Israel wants a partner for peace? The injustices of the settlements would need to be addressed with any legitimate peace.
Well, I think that's exactly what the point, what that point is, that it doesn't help Netanyahu, who I think is very hawkish on all these issues and expansionist when it comes to the West Bank. And I don't know what his future plans are for Gaza, but no, I think the letter writer hits on a point that you have to want peace, and I don't know that Netanyahu wants peace on anybody else's terms but his own, which is basically we're gonna smack you around, we're going to degrade your capacity to bother us, and then we're going to go back to being Israel, and that's it. And you can figure it out after
and,
that.
And a couple of the writers address in very interesting terms the whole question of strategy here on the Israel Lebanon front. Both Iran and Hezbollah, long before October 7th last year, were encouraging Hamas to do something big in Israel. Okay, and promising Hamas, if you do something big, we are in there with you 1,000%. Okay, well, the only thing that Hamas did, its operation. Hezbollah began to send shells across the border into Israel, normally hitting open fields or aimed near military installations, for the most part avoiding civilians, and they hoped they could get away with this as the grand gesture of support for the people of Palestine, and it backfired badly. It resulted in, we've seen over the last two or three weeks an Israeli campaign that has been absolutely devastating, whether it's, exploding pagers, exploding walkie-talkies, assassinations of key Hezbollah leaders. Hezbollah is in a position right now where, you know, its cadres don't know if they can communicate safely. The penetration of this organization by Israeli intelligence is absolutely stunning. Yeah. Absolutely stunning. And the Iranians are thinking the same way. They could not even protect a leader of Hamas in a government guest house under guard constantly. I would say that for Iran and Hezbollah, this is absolutely uncharted territory they're in.
A couple more letters, and we'll bring us up to the top of the hour. From Gregory, it will never be over. Every day Israel creates new enemies among the children who see death and destruction all around them. I'm so tired of this region and its endless conflict. The U.S. should divest from the whole area. Please play Kris Kristofferson music instead of circling around this horrible ongoing saga. Well, we're going to do both.
I was wondering, Joe, what, you know, if this was all taking place a year earlier, say October 7th had happened a year earlier, say we were now a year earlier, if it wasn't a presidential race, you know, a year of a presidential election, what would the U.S. be saying and doing right now? Because I think that you would see different activities and comments by the administration. I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but I think presidential politics are playing into the U.S.'s approach to this.
Yeah, I think you're right, March, and I think it's inevitable. Look, something on the order of 70% of Americans strongly support Israel. Whether rightly or wrongly, they consider Israel's enemies here, whether Palestinian or Iran or Hezbollah, to be the villains of the peace, okay? This electoral politics have an enormous impact on this. I think what we need to look for, perhaps, especially if Vice President Harris wins, might be some steps that President Biden could take in the closing days of his own incumbency aimed at pressuring Israel. Weapons suspensions. The United States perhaps becoming the 146th member of the United Nations to recognize Palestinian state sovereignty. There are.
I just got goosebumps when you said that.
Well, there are steps that might be taken, but to expect the administration to do anything along those lines between now and November 5th, I don't think it's going to happen.
Leonard writes to us and says, you have left out the context of the struggle. Israel has been conducting a battle of ethnically cleansed, a battle to ethnically cleanse greater Israel of Palestinians for decades. Hezbollah's attacks against Israel were explicitly conditioned on ending Israel's aggression against Gaza. Israel is expanding the war to drag us into a larger conflict. War is never an avenue to peace.
You know, Joe, as I've mentioned previously on this program, Israeli Jews and Palestinians have one thing certainly in common. Each side considers itself to be the righteous victim of the other side. And I think, you know, anybody who wants to play a role in coming to a solution of this crisis or just understanding it must have enough empathy to realize each side considers itself to be a righteous victim of the other side. Most Israelis believe, whether we like it or not, most Israelis believe that Palestinians are not willing to accept a Jewish state in the land between the Mediterranean Sea and the Jordan River. And of course, what Palestinians see is what many of them would describe as, settler colonialism. But each side has a view of the other side that is really in the form of righteous victimization.
One more letter, and then we'll go to a break. Norma writes, Netanyahu's taking advantage of a weak U.S. government during an election season and is attacking, to your point, March, and killing Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank and people in Lebanon. They are using U.S. taxpayer money, and the U.S. has lost any control of Israel. These are war crimes, and they weaken the reputation of the government of U.S. all over the world. That from Norma. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we will continue. We have many more items to discuss, many other items on the docket this morning. Next up, we're going to talk about the port strike and where that is at the moment and what that means. And, then we'll go to lighter stuff. Doubtful. We'll do all of that and much more after this break and news with Ray Graff.
He's a charmer, he'll charm her with money and manners that I never learned. He's a leader, he'll lead her across pretty bridges he's planning to burn.
Good morning. Welcome back to a busy roundtable on this first day of October. Coming up at 10:30 this morning, we'll talk to author and columnist and biographer Jonathan Alter about Jimmy Carter, who turns 100 today, his 100th birthday, and we'll be talking to Mr. Alter about that coming up. Let's see. Our next topic is about the port strike, and this is, this is a big deal, obviously, and something that we want to talk about. How long is it going to be in play? How long is it going to be something that we are talking about? That remains to be seen. Port workers are striking on the East and Gulf coasts. Members of International Longshoremen's Association walked out for the first time since 1977 in a standoff over wages, benefits, and job security. Members of the International Union, which represent roughly 45,000 workers, started setting up pickets after 11th-hour talks failed to avert a work stoppage. The move will cut off most trade through some of the busiest U.S. ports and could send a chill through the economy. "Nothing's going to move without us, nothing," said Harold Daggett, the president of the union, addressing picketers outside of a port terminal in Elizabeth, New Jersey. The U.S. Maritime Alliance, which represents port employers, declined to comment early Tuesday. The two sides were not able to agree on wage increases, and the use of new technology in the ports was a sticking point for the union. "We think they're lowballing intentionally," Leonard Riley, a longshoreman of the Port of Charleston in South Carolina, said on Tuesday. "We're going to be out until we have something to chew on." Businesses now face a period of great uncertainty. Trade experts say that a short strike would cause little lasting damages, but that a weeks-long stoppage could lead to shortages, higher prices, and even layoffs. Jay.
The one thing missing from this story, I did see one person say something to the effect that people don't have to run out and stock their shelves run to the grocery stores and do panic buying. It was like, oh, please don't take our toilet paper again, you know. it's frustrating to see this. I think the companies are playing something of a public relations game, as you know you would expect them to, in saying, "Well, we offered a 50% wage hike," and most people are going to look at that and say, "Wow, how could you say no to that?" What the context of that is apparently is a long, decades-long stagnation, effective stagnation in wages. So, the longshoremen want to make up for a whole lot of time all at once, and I don't blame them for it. And the other thing is just the fear of technology. It's something all across industries. People are afraid that their jobs are going to go away, and longshoremen jobs are They're good. They were once good jobs. I remember when I first got to Albany, there was a shipment of bananas. That was the big thing that used to come through the port of Albany was bananas. And it was a periodic thing. And it was people, they weren't working full time. And they came, and my editor said, go down and cover a banana ship coming in. And you'll just be amazed. And it'd be a good story. And it was fascinating. Just, and the joy of people working, knowing they were going to get a hell of a paycheck at the end of the day, was just, and that, so that was 87 roughly. Things have changed since then. The thing I just worry about as a normal person, hopefully, is how long does this last, and right. Do we go back to a supply? Just hearing everybody's excuse for bad service when it comes to acquiring goods is, well, the supply chain.
And price escalation. Yeah. I mean, yeah. I think, we saw that during the pandemic, right? People use supply chain factors as a way to increase prices, and it caused inflation. And a lot of that was probably based on greed. Some of it was legitimate. It's funny you talk about bananas, because I was reading this morning that, perishable goods are really at issue here, and that 75% of the national supply of bananas comes in through the East Coast ports, and that's 3.8 million tons of bananas a year. We don't really think about, where things come from. And also east-west division in terms of which ports are more active have really changed over the pandemic. We saw a big shift to the eastern ports. Now it's kind of swinging back. It's always been around 47-52%, percent. And now it's shifting back. So I think it does impact the overall picture. But, the longshoreman, the top hourly salary is $29 an hour. That does sound like a pittance for extremely dangerous and difficult work. That's around, $80,000 a year or something at best. And then people are working and earning overtime. And then it seems to me we as a human race, do not do a good job preparing for technological changes and how they're going to impact entire workforces. We're not good at retraining people. Look at what happened with coal, right? We're not good at slowing the impact of automation on particular people, or making sure that it's really only going to take out workers as they retire. Could we do automation through attrition? Automation is going to happen. It's hit the European ports are much more automated than we are. And you could see a time when a container, from the time it comes off the ship to the time it goes on a truck, is fully automated. That's what the longshoremen are concerned about. So there's a lot going on here, and it really speaks to wider failures in our ability to retrain and restrain how automation growth happens. And again, automation, what's the benefit? It increases profits at the expense of workers.
We welcome your letters on the subject, panel at WAMC.org. Fred Hall.
Yeah, my understanding is the Longshoremen Union is seeking a 77% wage increase over 6 years. Management is now offering 50% over 6 years. So I will go way out on a limb and suggest that there is a settlement likely to be
somewhere
reached
in the middle, right?
In the 60-65% range. And look, I realize there are other issues. Automation and other things, but I don't want to sound complacent about this, but it just doesn't seem to present a negotiating challenge anywhere near what we were discussing previously on this panel.
One thing I was just to add to the mix is, how this is going to play out, because everything is going to play out in presidential politics. And I'm sure that Donald Trump, we're going to hear from him in the next day or two, that if he had been in charge, this wouldn't have happened and he could step in right now and settle the whole thing. And what's interesting is that the president does have the power to stop this
Taft-Hartley.
The Taft-Hartley. And Biden has strategically, and I think wisely, and with a degree of actual integrity that we don't always see in politicians, said, I'm not going to do this because I'm not going to weaken the union's position. At least I think that's his motivation. And Trump, who's trying to jockey for I'm the better union guy, is going to come out and basically say, I would have used Taft-Hartley, and not understanding that That's exactly the opposite position from what a pro-union president ought to do.
So. There's been a lot of preparation in anticipation of this strike. So there's been a lot of stockpiling, you know, to get goods ready. A lot of the major retailers have bought in advance knowing that this could be coming. And I think we will see impacts before the presidential, you know, before the election day. But those impacts will probably be muted by some of this prep in advance, which is probably a good thing because, you know, this strike should not be what decides the presidential election in the United States and the lack of a banana at the supermarket.
Has anyone else noticed that the bananas in the last 2 months have just been like hideously green when you go?
How I want them.
Well, I know.
Because I hang them. So.
Well, right.
Yeah.
But you can't find a yellow banana.
Oh no! I have to scrounge for that for that perfect bunch that's going to last me a week.
I'll give you the name of the store. Yeah, that's all they're there.
I wish Harry Belafonte was still around to comment on this.
Well, it's anyone else have anything on that before I move on to
bananas of the strike?
Either. Fine. I give it to you. Let's move on and talk about other issues. And the other big story, of course, that we have been following, and I feel that, you know, we want to get to as a panel is the storm that is ravaging this country, Hurricane Helene, who came in and really. Roughed up a lot of areas, including North Carolina, Western North Carolina, especially Asheville and in that region, but other areas that have seen great destruction and great, certainly, just large swaths of really awful outcomes after the storm moved through. The other thing I think is important to say about this is that while the subject is crews are on the scene, crews are working, crews are trying to do the best they can do, but much like March was saying earlier, how would things be different in issue number one that we discussed? How would things be different if it wasn't an election year? Well, how would things be different here if it wasn't an election year? The two candidates for president ventured carefully into the politics of Hurricane Helene on Monday, with Vice President Harris canceling West Coast campaign stops to attend a storm briefing in Washington. Former President Donald Trump delivering remarks from a Georgia city battered by the storm. Trump blasted the administration's response as inadequate during a trip to severely damaged Valdosta, Georgia, where while Harris gave remarks at the headquarters of FEMA in Washington, aiming to reassure the public that the administration was actively and decisively but sensibly working in the storm's wake. I plan to be on the ground as soon as possible without disrupting any emergency response operations. Meanwhile, Donald Trump, by the way, I just want to remind you all that the first line of this article was the two candidates ventured carefully. I would argue one ventured carefully, one maybe not as much. The Trump team has been faulting Harris for fundraising during the storm and for being absent in the areas hardest hit. And also saying that Harris is saying that politicians should keep themselves out of these areas. And meanwhile, the former President Trump is saying in several remarks that he made yesterday that they were not helping Republican governors. He was speaking specifically about the governor of Georgia, and that the governor of Georgia was asking for help and was not getting that help because he was a Republican. Well, first of all, there's the kerfuffle between the governor of Georgia and former President Trump. So that's one thing. Then number two, they went to Governor Kemp and said, well, what about this? And he said, well, I was just on the phone with him, and he offered me anything I needed and said, you know, call me and I'll do whatever I need to do. And they said, well, did you feel that was adequate? And he said, yeah, what more would you want? So, and there we go. Stir, mix, enjoy.
Look, we all remember Trump in Puerto Rico throwing the paper towel roll. He has no compassion. And I think we all need to focus on Project 2025 that wants to break up NOAA and privatize the Weather Service, you know, gut the National Hurricane Center. What I see is a lot of mis and false information that could be coming from outside the United States, by the way, about the fact that Biden and Harris are not providing support, that the National Guard is not on the ground, which is absolutely not true. The National Guard has been mobilized in the affected states, you know, but, you know, people are being fed a lot of misinformation. And I heard on, you know, on NPR National today that there are people in Asheville just getting service for the first time by going to, you know, publicly located Wi-Fi, seeing the pictures and just learning about the devastation themselves. It is not appropriate to land someone of Harris's stature right now. It would take a huge amount of airtime. You have to basically ground all air flights during that landing of someone of her position, and that would harm the recovery efforts. So she's being wise about waiting. However, this misinformation has to be battled. I personally feel like going on X/Twitter and screenshotting comments from Biden and posting them in comments because people are saying he hasn't made a statement. He has. There are activities happening, and it's just not – the news of that is not getting out. It's very frustrating.
Yeah, it's terribly frustrating to listen to – but this is Trump's modus operandi. You know, he came in two outright lies. The idea that Biden wasn't giving them any help, and here's the Georgia governor saying yes, he did, and then getting out there with over the weekend comments about climate change that it's a hoax, and then finally at the end of the Washington Post, or you read all the way to the end, you have to endure Trump saying, well, this isn't the time for politics. It's all about politics with this guy. The fact that a person who has no business, Franklin Graham, could have gone, could have delivered any supplies that he was going to deliver without the help of Donald Trump, who certainly wasn't lifting anything or doing anything. So he was there as a political candidate. And you know, this is the Kobayashi Maru. There is no way anybody gets out of any candidate gets out of this doing anything that their opponent can't attack. You're attacked if you don't get on the ground. You're attacked if you do get on the ground. You're attacked if you stay in the air. You're attacked. You know, it's, and you just have to take a step back. And, oh, right. This is how politics is. And I'm not going to let my head explode over it.
Yeah, I think in a catastrophe of this nature, rule number one is that politicians who have large security footprints absolutely need to stay away from the area. Absolutely. I mean, on the good side of this, I heard on the news this morning, at least I thought I heard, and I hope it's true, that New York National Guardsmen have been dispatched to North Carolina. And as a New York taxpayer, New York voter, New York resident, I'm very proud to hear that. I'm glad it's happening. But the politicians, need to stay out. Let the professionals do the job of saving lives and restoring services.
Yeah, that was the thing that impressed me. What you mentioned about the planes having to be grounded if the president flies in, you have to ground everything. And it's like in the middle of a crisis like this, you're going to do that? That would be crazy.
That's ego. Yeah. I mean, if Harris flew in there, I think the criticism heaped on her would be way bigger than the criticism for standing back and doing what she's doing from FEMA. The toll here is just absolutely mind-bogglingly enormous. I have no idea when Asheville or these other mountain towns will recover, if ever. You know, just speaking from Ulster County's perspective, you know, we had 13 inches of rain in the Catskills during Hurricane Irene, and we are still not fully recovered in some areas from that. And they had three times that. I mean, 30 inches of rain fell in some areas. I don't know that we were really thinking about hurricanes coming inland in this way, being a major risk moving forward. This crisis has changed the way I personally look at preparation. I was thinking bigger bridges, bigger culverts. You cannot prepare for this kind of deluge, which means that you, from an infrastructure perspective, which means that you really have to harden your response capabilities so that when you have something like this, you're able to get in and go, which is going to be things like helicopters and satellite radio and, you know, things that are really normally much more used in a military context.
Amphibious vehicles.
Yeah, this is really scary, and we're going to see more of this, and this is really going to change the way we have to prepare. I had kind of looked at Irene and said that's a one-time thing. You know, Sandy hit New York, but New York's a harbor. New York's on the ocean. Upstate is not. Well, you know what? Asheville is not on the coast, and this is tremendous, tremendous damage.
All right, we just have a few moments before the bottom of the hour, and as I mentioned, just after the news break, we're going to welcome Jonathan Alter to our program and talk about Jimmy Carter and his 100th birthday. And I think that is I've made no bones about it. I'm a big Jimmy Carter fan and grew up with him and have had opportunities several times to interview him. So I just think I wanted to spend some time talking about his legacy before he passes while he celebrates this landmark, and we'll do so with Jonathan Alter coming up at 10:30. Real quick, though, bonus topic, someone who was very present in my life as a child and passed away yesterday, and that, of course, is Pete Rose. Died yesterday, and it was, of course, a complicated figure in sports, a complicated figure even outside of sports, but of course was a I have to be careful of what I said because Fred has already taken issue with some of my my claims early on, but you have someone who has excelled in many in the game. And has done this amazing accomplishment, and was all but thought to be a Hall of Famer on the first ballot, and then 3 years later was embattled with a gambling, scandal. It turned out to be true, and then later went to prison for a short time. So a very complicated figure, and yet someone who was really one of the greats of the game. And I say that as someone who watched him bring a World Series championship to the city of Philadelphia in 1980, and just as a young kid, I haven't figured out how old I was, 13? That was a really, really big deal. Jay? Yeah.
You know, I am not a person that follows sports very well.
Let me go to Fred. and I only say to Fred because we have very little time. But I want to, Fred was making the case that maybe the resume was a bit exaggerated.
Well, let me be positive first. I think early in his career, the great Yankee left-handed pitcher Whitey Ford was the one who labeled Pete Rose Charlie Hustle. I believe Rose, during a spring training game, got a walk, but instead of walking or just trotting to first base, he ran almost full speed to first base. So, Charlie Hustle. I think the main thing about Pete Rose is he was a guy who absolutely made the most of the talent he had. He was not talented in the sense of Ty Cobb, Babe Ruth, Tris Speaker, Joe DiMaggio, Mickey Mantle, Willie Mays. He was able to play for a long time, 24 years. relatively injury-free. He was a decent hitter for baseball fans out there. 303 lifetime batting average, 375 on base average. If his career had been compressed to 15 years, he would not have had the stats that people cite, the all-time hit leader. He was also the all-time leader in making outs. Okay, so my view of Pete Rose's greatness as a ball player is somewhat more limited than Joe's.
My takeaway, Joe, if I could just break in, is to say gambling is a disease. Addiction to gambling is a disease, and it's a heartbreaking one. And that's the story I take away.
Yeah. Well, and I think there's a lot of takeaways from his life and lessons, certainly, that he learned over time. We are going to take a break when we come back. Jonathan Alter is going to join us. We'll talk about the 100th birthday of Jimmy Carter. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this.
I know it's over, but life goes on, and this old world will keep on turning.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. I just want to make note that the breaking news being that Iran is preparing an imminent ballistic missile attack against Israel, according to U.S. officials, and that story just breaking within the last 5 or 10 minutes. And obviously, we'll have much more on that throughout the morning and during Midday Magazine today, as we just heard from the BBC. As I mentioned, I was very much looking forward to this segment. It is Jimmy Carter's 100th birthday, and we celebrate the occasion with Jonathan Alter, the columnist, historian, documentary filmmaker. He is the author of what I feel is the definitive biography of the 39th President of the United States, His Very Best, Jimmy Carter, A Life, a book that came out, I believe, in 2020, and still is just an amazing look, and I think makes a really good case about the strengths and successes that were seen during a Carter administration. Jonathan Alter, always good to talk to you. Thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure. It's great to be here.
Thank you very much for being on the program. When you look at this, I mean, especially given that hospice and his health and the death of his wife and seeing him so fragile, that to be here on a 100th birthday is just it not only a chance to celebrate the man, but also historic in many, many ways.
It really is. Not only is he the first American president to reach that milestone, but he not too long ago broke the informal record for longest time in hospice. It was at the beginning of 2023 that he went into hospice after he had been in the hospital, and he didn't want to be apart from his wife of 77 years, Rosalind Carter, anymore. He didn't want to be in the hospital anymore. And so he just issued instructions that he would not go back into the hospital. And it provided a big boost for the hospice movement. But then he stayed alive. And a lot of people thought that he wouldn't make it after Rosalind Carter died in late 2023. But what I heard from my friends in Plains, Georgia, is that he basically felt like he didn't think he was able to take care of her the way he had in the past. They had taken care of each other, and he felt she was safer in God's hands. And so he was able to survive his bereavement over her death. And they had an extraordinary relationship. They knew each other for 96 years, if you can imagine.
Wow.
That.
Wow.
I do think that it's important to to understand that, you know, his longevity is partly a function of luck, as it is in anybody's case, partly a function of modern medicine. He got a drug called Keytruda after he got metastatic melanoma in 2015 that just worked miracles for him. And it had gone to his brain. It didn't affect his brain. The cancer didn't affect his brain. And it was zapped by this drug, Keytruda. And he also, when I discussed it with him, he also said a lot of it was the power of prayer, and that reflects his genuine faith. He was the most, you know, is the most devout president, arguably, in all of our history.
You say that in office he was a political failure. He lost overwhelmingly to Ronald Reagan, of course, but he was a substantive and visionary success. So put that into a context for us.
Well, I think people, they tend to focus on the political failures and the failure of, to get the hostages out sooner from Iran, although he did get them home safely. Just as Ronald Reagan was taking the oath, so he didn't think that that was a fiasco that some other people did, and I think there's something to be said for that. And in other parts of foreign policy, he was enormously accomplished. The Camp David Accords that made peace between Israel and Egypt, the most enduring peace treaty of the post-war period. Can you imagine if Israel was having to fight Egypt today basically a fifth war. The normalization of relations with China, which is the foundation of the global economy for all of our problems with China. The human rights policy that helped transform the world. The Panama Canal treaties, which prevented a major war in Central America. And then on the domestic side, 15 major pieces of environmental legislation that allowed utilities to use clean energy for the first time, subsidized clean energy. He was the first president to talk about climate. Very, very visionary president in many respects, even as there were economic conditions that were harming him, his lack of communication skills, especially in comparison to Reagan, harmed him. But, journalists look at how popular presidents are. When I take off my journalist hat and put on my historian hat, we're supposed to look at how their policies changed the world. And on that basis, Jimmy Carter doesn't belong on Mount Rushmore, but he stands up quite well, and he has a record of genuine accomplishment. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal today by Phil Graham, a very, very conservative former congressman. And it was in praise of Jimmy Carter's deregulatory agenda, which helped the trucking and rail deregulation, helped create the modern just-in-time delivery systems, allows for Amazon and FedEx, airline deregulation, cut fares in half. It's much more easy to fly to to see your grandmother than right. It was when Carter was president. I could go on and on about the kind of singles and doubles that he hit and all of the bills that he signed. But I think that the larger point is that he's a moral exemplar. And we see that in his work in his post-presidency as well. He's become a global humanitarian icon. And, where Donald Trump is corrupt and chaotic and cruel, Jimmy Carter is honest and disciplined and decent. And so I think that character counts, and Carter is an example of how true character, for all of his flaws, and he had many that I illuminate in the book. For all of his flaws, he is a man of true character, and we still can produce those figures in our political life.
I mean, you look at his life, a peanut farmer and a governor of Georgia, a president, a Nobel Peace Prize laureate. It's an astonishing resume, and so much of us, I mean, many of us don't even know him from his presidency, but know him from his post-presidency. And that certainly has been fascinating to watch. Because that's not like going to a image consultant and saying, how do you make me look better in the latter part of my career? That's just starting the Carter Center and doing work that he felt was essential for not only the country, but for the world.
Right. And he could have easily cashed in, done what a lot of other former presidents have done, and, you know, served on corporate boards, given these big speeches for $1 million. Instead, you know, his speaking fees go to the Carter Center to help eradicate disease in Africa, you know, and he's made his living all these years in the last 45 years by writing books. He's written 30 books on everything from woodworking to fishing to the Middle East. And to his childhood, and you know, so he's really led a really commendable American life, and I think that we need that kind of inspiration now in our political life.
Jay,
yeah, I bristle a bit whenever anybody talks about Carter negatively, looking back. And and you're right, there were plenty of flaws in the man. But I always come back to his, I mean, he is set. We used this term when we were having a discussion as an editorial board about this the other day. He's really set the gold standard for what a post-presidency looks like. I mused to the group, well, you know, you could make an argument that Clinton, with the Clinton Global Initiative, has done some good work, but I don't think you get the whole package with Clinton, unfortunately. A little too much baggage going into that post-presidency and into that legacy. But Carter, building houses for poor people, and putting on a work belt and doing it himself. I don't like, as a journalist, as a citizen, I don't like having religion intrude into the public sphere too much, but Carter did not use his faith as a prop. He didn't use it as a cudgel against other politicians or against people. And it just, I really like the guy. It's not a thing for a journalist to say, usually, but impressed me.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's really hard not to admire him. You know, when he was president, he could be prickly and difficult. And I asked his son, Jeff, a wonderful guy, he would use one word to describe his father, what would it be? And he said, intense. And that's very true. He's not this, you know, the smile is a little bit misleading, as his national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, said. He really has three smiles. He's got the big public smile. Then he's got a tight smile when he's annoyed at you, and he drills into you with those steely blue eyes, and the temperature in the room, you know, drops. And then he's got the genuine smile when somebody gets off a witty line. And so there's a complexity there, but underneath the complexity, underneath whatever issue somebody might have with them, there's a core decency and humanity and a selflessness. So he is ambitious for himself. I mean, I think he wanted to be the first president who lived to 100. He wanted to break the record for longest time in hospice. But, and he's no politician is actually humble or truly self-effacing. You can't be.
It's a great point. Yeah.
But, you know, having said that, you know, he was ambitious not just for himself, but genuinely got up every day trying to figure out how to make the world a better place, and succeeded in so many different areas in doing that. And you know, this is, as you said, it sets a gold standard for not just what former presidents can do, but like all of us, we can't all be Jimmy Carter, but we can all like get out of ourselves enough to think about working for a cause larger than our own self-interest.
Let me just end with this, because we only have about a minute left, but the family has made very clear that one of the things that he wanted to live to do was to vote for Kamala Harris.
Correct. Yeah, he told that. So his mind is still fairly clear, even though he's very, very old and frail. And he told his grandson, Jason Carter, who runs the Carter Center, that he wanted to live long enough to vote for Kamala Harris. And early voting in Georgia starts in about a week to 10 days. There's no predicting at that age how he'll do, but I think we can
I wouldn't vote against
confidently
it.
Say, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Also, I think that we can confidently say that whenever his time comes, he'll go off to a heavenly reward.
Absolutely. Jonathan Alter has been our guest. He is the author of just the amazing biography, His Very Best, Jimmy Carter, A Life. I just want to quickly say that Jonathan Alter has an amazing new book coming out about the Trump trial, American Reckoning Inside Trump's Trial, and my own. That comes out in October, and Jonathan will be back to talk to us about that then. So, Jonathan, a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much. Great talking to you guys.
Be well. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.